Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith. So today we're talking to Bob Taylor, who has a long history with gay bars in Florida as well as Georgia. Welcome, Bob.
Hey, Art. Thank you. Proud to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you for what you're doing, too. We're appreciative. Our community deserves this.
Well, thank you. And I am learning so much. I understand that your career with the gay bar scene started in Tampa at a long-lost club known as Renee's Disco.
That is true. So I was in college, and I was like 18, maybe 19, and I was dancing on the dance floor at Renee's, and a person who would eventually become my mentor, my drag mother, one of two of my drag mothers, the other one being Tina DeVore in Atlanta, Tiffany Middlesex at Renee's, fingered me over with her little, talking about, come over here, and let me talk to you, and she told me that I had rhythm. And they needed a dancer. She had a guy who broke his leg or broke his ankle or something. And would I be interested? And of course, I was sort of gagging. I'm like, well, yeah, but I didn't know what that meant. Went to rehearsal. I danced for her backup that weekend. And I backup danced for Lakeisha Lucky that weekend. And they asked me to come back the following weekend. And it went over really good again. So they offered me a job on cast and asked if I knew how to perform like as an entertainer on my own, and I told them no, but they quickly taught me how, and we picked some Wham music and Dead or Alive, I think, and some things, and we helped make some costumes, and the next thing you know, I'm in the show on the cast, and that was for 3 years before I headed to Atlanta.
Now, Renee's was quite an interesting place.
Yes, it was.
It was located over on Kennedy, not yep. far from where the club known as The Kennedy is now.
Right.
And some reports I've heard about the club claim that it had a swimming pool. Was there a swimming pool there when you were working there?
Yes, but it wasn't inside per se, but it was within the compound. So Renee's had a big wall around it. You went in the front doors and you went into all the disco and the pool table room and the back bar and all that. But over through the disco was another little door to go outside, and it was behind this 8-foot wall, and the swimming pool and another bar was out there. Okay. That was one of two bars, which we'll get to in a minute, that had a swimming pool attached to it that I worked in.
Indeed it is. And I know the answer to that question. I've been there.
Yeah. Yep.
So you were working with Tiffany Middlesex, who at the time was quite the celebrity. If I recall correctly, in the early 80s, she was, what, Miss Florida USA or something? She won a big title here.
Well, actually, she came from Toledo in like the mid-70s to Tampa. She entered Miss Florida. Miss Florida, FI, is the big pageant that's been around since the early 70s, one of the oldest ones like Miss America in our country. And she entered it and got second runner-up, but she wanted to win so bad, she took a year off and came back in 1980, and she won the contest and was hired immediately as show director at Renee's, and the rest is history. She became one of the most famous show directors in this country because she's also an MC and choreographer, and she choreographed the opening to every pageant we ever had in Florida, including Miss Florida, many years in a row.
And
great mentor.
Yes, I know Tiffany well. She lives not hey. Far from me. And
you live in Tampa?
I do.
I thought you lived in Atlanta. I am so confused. I didn't know that.
I lived in Atlanta for quite a number of years, from 83 to 98. And then briefly again in the mid-2000s. But I've known Tiffany for a long time. I remember seeing her perform in the early 80s at the Copa in Fort Lauderdale and numerous places in Tampa. And as I recall, she was pretty well known for her Tina Turner type presentation. She did a lot of that kind of wild and crazy, sexy dancing.
That and her Patti LaBelle, and just she was one of those girls that used to wear the very long fingernails, like Bertha Butt from Levitas in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
And she would do the hand fan, you know, doing Patti and those fingernails. And that was, you know, she would get all crazy and arch her back and almost touch her head on the floor holding some note. She was a high power entertainer. She always got a lot of applause and made a lot of money from tips.
Absolutely. Now, when you were backup dancing for Tiffany, that was the beginning of your career at Renee's. And did you continue to do that as a backup dancer with the drag shows there, or did you move on to doing just your own shows?
Well, I continued dancing backup for the girls because to me, they were celebrities in this community, bigger than anything else. And I wanted to be part of that somehow. I love the beauty. I love the glamour, but I like this competition thing, this pageant thing that I was just learning about. I had been to the Miss Illusions pageant in Atlanta in 1983, fresh out of high school, but I didn't know what that was. I just thought it was fascinating. I was watching a beauty pageant with drag queens, but I didn't know much about what it really meant and how all that unfolded until I went to my first Miss Florida, which was 1986, and Mahogany won. And then right after that is when all this unfolded that I went to work at Renee's in 86. So what I did was I kept dancing back up, but I ultimately started competing in the Mr. Florida USA, Mr. Orlando, Mr. Tampa, et cetera, et cetera. And I won very few. I entered a whole lot. I won very few. I placed in most, but a lot of times I just didn't win. I qualified for a national competition and I went one time and it wasn't my cup of tea. I did very well, actually. I made the 10 the final night, but I just realized that I was much more enamored with the drags and everything like that, the trans girls, the drag queens, all this stuff. I was much more intrigued by all that. So I wanted to stay entertaining because I love to entertain, but I didn't want to compete anymore. So I think I competed for about 7 or 8 years during those years. And then I finally just walked away from all that. And then in the late 90s, I became a pageant promoter, meaning I owned a preliminary in Florida to the Miss Continental pageant in Chicago. And I did that for several years. And since then, I have also been a promoter for the Miss Gay National pageant, which is no longer in existence. And I also was a 6-year promoter for the Gay US of A system, most recently in the mid 2000s. So yeah, and then I finally retired as an entertainer in 2013 at the Parliament House in Orlando. I had a big, huge retirement party, last performance. I'm happy to say, like, 1,500 people were there. It was kind of fascinating.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's a fascinating scene. And back in the 80s, the scene in Tampa was pretty hopping. If I have my math correct, in the early 80s in Tampa, the other competition for Renee's was El Goya, which was over in Ybor, and then kind of transitioned into part of a national kind of franchise of gay bars called Trax.
Correct. And I also was a cast member at Trax for a year and a half.
And what did you do there? Same thing?
I'm actually, interesting enough, I only backup danced or did the lead to productions where a guy was needed for the voice. I didn't do my own entertainment, independent entertainment there, because at that time it just wasn't things. This just wasn't what people did. That's not what was going on. I had just left Atlanta where I left Tampa in 89, went to Atlanta, joined Levitas for 90 and 91. Levitas closed down again, and I came back to Tampa, and this time Middlesex had transitioned from Renee's over to Trax as the show director, and she hired me, of course, easily, and put me right to work in the show. But I just never did independent entertainment there. That would not start back again until 1996 when I went to the Parliament House.
So at Trax, and for people who don't know, back in the day, in the time frame we're talking about, the late 80s, early 90s, drag was a lot different than it is now. For the most part, the cabarets or the drag bars had very large stages, and they did production numbers. It wasn't one drag queen in one outfit lip syncing to a song. There were a number of drag queens who actually did their own vocals, but they almost always had some sort of backup dancers, you know, a troupe of either other drag queens or male dancers to enhance the performance, kind of like you see in a big Hollywood production. It wasn't
exactly right. Exactly right.
And all the bars that you mentioned were like that. Illusions in Atlanta, it was known as the Showplace of the South.
That's right.
They launched the careers of many well-known drag queens over the years that they were open.
As did the Sweet Gumhead, which I love to plug Marty Padgett's book that I just finished reading about the nightlife in Atlanta in the 70s and early 80s. Atlanta was a true stomping ground for a lot of drag entertainment too, but as was Renee's in Tampa. Tampa was a hotbed. Dana Douglas, Amber Richards, Vicki Lawrence, so many of the divas from yesteryear came right out of that bar.
Yeah, and Trax, which I think was a gay bar in at least three different incarnations, originally El Goya, then Trax, and later Pleasure Dome.
That's right.
Was a large building. It took up about half a city block. It was technically three stories tall, although
it was
never performed or went upstairs, really, except for dressing rooms, maybe.
Dressing rooms and the management offices were all up there.
But the main floor had a huge dance room. It had a lobby bar. It had a second dance floor area. It had an outdoor jungle themed. It was a very expansive facility. And actually, just recently, within the past year or so, it was completely redone. The outside had to remain the same because of its historic significance.
Right.
But the inside was gutted and redone, and they added a large addition to it, and it is now a luxury boutique hotel.
Yeah, I drove by it a few weeks ago when I went over to see my drag mother in Tampa and one of my drag daughters, and I drove by it, and it was like, wow, it was big back then, but now it seems like a huge monstrosity there. It's huge. Well,
they took the whole parking lot and made it into an extension of the property with parking, I think, on the lower levels.
That parking lot is also famous in itself.
It is.
not only did a lot of things go on in that parking lot at night, but during Gay Pride, the few years I was in Florida for Gay Pride in Tampa, they would bring a flatbed trailer that hooked up to a tractor trailer, like a diesel.
Right.
A big flatbed trailer, and they would set it out there, and it would be decorated, and that was our stage for Gay Pride. And it was really quite phenomenal because, you know, you could fit a lot of people in that parking lot when they're standing.
Oh, absolutely.
It was really cool. I have a picture of that somewhere in my archives.
We actually recently, well, not so recently, 6 years ago, used that same parking lot for the Tampa vigil for the Pride Massacre. A couple days after
They did the same thing.
They brought a big trailer in. They brought a couple of fire trucks with the buckets to use for lighting and whatever and hang flags. And they did a huge event there. But and when I first went to Trax or El Goya, well, it was still El Goya at the time. It was El Goya / Trax.
Yeah.
In transition. And when I went there the first time, I remember being told that you have to park in that parking lot adjacent to the building and walk to the front door. Otherwise, you might not make it. Because
That's
at
right.
the time, the neighborhood was a little sketchy. And
people
if you parked
sketchy.
A couple of blocks away, it was not necessarily safe for gay people. But
yeah, the way they all walk down the streets there in Ybor now was not necessarily how it was all the time back then. That was when you saw people packing in the streets in Ybor back in those days, it was for some sort of the Gasparilla parade or the Pride parade or 4th of July parade or whatever have you. You didn't see it like how they freely run up and down the streets now. It wasn't quite like that back in our day. You had to run from the parking lot to the bar because you might get shot.
But I remember going to Trax and to Pleasure Dump both. And I believe it was Trax. I was staying with a friend downtown at the Hilton, and we went there several times. And it was like maybe on a Tuesday night or something that they used to have a 25-cent drink night, and it would be packed in there. And you could get drunk for like less than $10. You could have all the alcohol and still tip the bartenders. And they drew crazy crowds there. I have very, very many fond memories at Trax and Pleasure Dome both.
Me too. Me too. Lots and lots and lots of fun in those places.
Now, unfortunately, that club is gone now, and there is no big dance club in Ybor anymore.
Nope. Actually, I hear there's a new club in St. Pete that's now the dance club, and I think the people that own the Honey Pot are the owners of this new place in St. Pete. I think. I don't know that.
I've heard rumors. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
So after you worked at Renee's and then went to Trax, you then went up to Atlanta.
I went to Atlanta in between Renee's and Trax.
Oh, okay.
I was at Renee's from 86 to 89, almost like three, four years. And then I left there. I actually graduated college and had a degree. And the company that I had been working for in Tampa out at, I think it's called Rocky Point there at Clearwater Causeway out there. I worked in one of those high rises out there, and they were an advertising firm, and they, I did really good in college, and I'm an accountant. That was what my major was. And they needed someone to take over the Atlanta operation, which was in Buckhead. And when they told me that, I'm like, Buckhead? I mean, how can I say no? So I took the job and went, got up there, and I went to work for 2 weeks. I allowed myself 2 weeks to get settled. And on the third week, I went to La Vida's, which had just had a grand opening. And I legitimately walked up to Tina DeVore and said, "Hello, are you Tina DeVore?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, my name is Bob Taylor, and I want to work here because I work for Tiffany Middlesex at Renee's in Tampa." And I guess I thought that was like a card, like a business card that would get me in the door by telling her that. And when I tell you, she became my other drag mother, my mentor, but she legitimately giggled and said, "Well, you sure are precious. We have auditions Thursday if you want to come in." The beautiful thing that happened is I went into the audition and I was the only guy. So I got the job. And I became the only male lead there for almost two straight years. And we had a cast of, I think, eight or nine girls and me. We did three shows a night, four nights a week. It was pretty fierce. And there was a swimming pool inside this particular show bar.
There was. And that
there was.
Story,
I may have gotten in it a few times.
That story goes back decades before.
Because it was a bathhouse originally, right?
It was a complex of sorts that at one time it was called Hollywood Hots.
Right.
And then it was called Locker Room. Locker Room was a legitimate bathhouse, but they also had a show stage. And then it was
Which is really fascinating if you think about it for a minute. Boys naked in towels watching drag.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It was a crazy place. And it also, at different points in its history, was known as Lipsticks.
Yep.
And I believe...
Actually, La Vida's, Lipsticks, La Vida's.
Right.
Before it was finally gone forever.
If I remember correctly, the La Vida's name was a nod to a famous Atlanta drag queen who had performed at the Sweet Gumhead, which was right down the street.
That's exactly right. And of course, you know me. That's La Vida Allen.
There she is.
And she is the person that La Vida's was named after because she was quite the sensation in Atlanta. And I even learned more about her in this book. I didn't know near as much. I mean, my mentors in Atlanta had told me Atlanta is real good on teaching history of the history before you and before them to know kind of how you got where you are. That's something that we're not seeing a lot with the new generation. They're bypassing all the legend stuff and the history and going on TV and getting on RuPaul and thinking that's where the history is. And in true form, the RuPaul stuff will be part of our history and is already starting to become that because it's been around now over a decade. But we're really failing to tell people who La Vida Allen was and who Rachel Wells was. It was fascinating, quite frankly. And so that's kind of what people like myself, that's kind of how we hold on to the history. We teach that. I actually hold a class with some of my kids that we can talk about later where it's called Drag 101. And they have to watch certain movies like... Marilyn Monroe and Tony, and what do you call it? Some Like It Hot. They have to watch Wizard of Oz. They have to watch certain things, Gone with the Wind. So they kind of have the gay etiquette and understand what, you know, gay is about. And then we also make them watch some of the early beauty pageants, like Miss Florida from the early 80s or late 70s, or Miss Gay America from the 70s and 80s. Because what happens is when they're sitting there watching them, all of a sudden they see a very, very young version of a much older entertainer that's maybe retired or semi-retired now, and they're fascinated. They're like, oh my God, that's like Tasha Long or whatever. And when she was like 12, you know, 20 maybe. And they're fascinated because a lot of these people, you know, they change over the years and they get to see what they kind of look like and how they entertain back long before these new entertainers came into the picture. Kind of interesting, really, the whole circle of it.
Yeah, and the Levitas in Atlanta was operated by the same people, the Vera family, that operated Backstreet and Weekends.
That's right.
And later Weekends Warehouse.
That's
and
right.
Numerous other clubs in Atlanta. They were a pretty big deal in the Atlanta scene. But when they operated Levitas, I remember the first time I walked in there and I thought to myself, oh my God, this is so weird. I'm standing near the back bar getting a drink and I could literally put my foot in the pool. There was no fence or no wall around it. It was just wide open in the middle of the
area.
And you could watch a drag show on the edge of, at the edge of the pool. And occasionally while I was there, I would see drag queens after they were done performing for the night, just dive in the pool. You know, it was like, there it is. Which of course,
we all did that at least once. Lily White was famous for doing it, but we all did it like at least once each to say we did it. And you're right, there was no fence around it. And I'm thinking to myself, what kind of blessing did that place have on it not to have some queer fall over drunk or high from drugs into the pool and either drown or hurt themselves and sue and own everything in the block, you know?
Yeah.
They got lucky. That never happened.
At that time, we weren't quite as litigious as we are now. So we were just grateful to have places like that where
they were
large and clean and well-run and safe places for us to go and hang out and socialize.
That's right. We use clean a little bit loose when we say that, because if you went in those same bars in the daytime, you'd be very shocked.
Right.
But they were, for the most part, kept pretty, you know, neat and clean. They really were. And it was nice to have safe places because we didn't have anywhere to go that we wouldn't get hurt or made fun of. And those were our places. And it's just so weird not to have them really around anymore. So many places like that are gone, as we'll continue to talk about, I'm sure, coming up here.
Yeah, Levitas was just an amazing place. And then it transferred. I think it was still under the ownership of the Veras, but they allowed Ron Sanford to come in and rebrand it as Lipsticks, correct? Isn't that how that happened?
Yep. They opened the Sweet Gum Head ended, and then 4 or 5 years later, maybe not even quite that long, Levitas opened right around the time Levita Allen died, I believe in 85. I can't remember exactly off the top of my head. They named it in her honor, and then for whatever reason, it didn't last long. I don't know any details about that. I'm still trying to find those details out. But Ron came in and opened Lipsticks and ran Lipsticks for a year, maybe two at most. And for whatever reason, and I don't know, Ron's kind of one of my mentors, really. He's kind of like my drag dad, really. But I don't know why Ron, I don't ask him about his personal business affairs. He's very private about all that, as he should be. But I know that Ron had to leave and he wound up going over to Ponce de Leon and opening a new venue called Lipsticks over there. It was a smaller venue. And when he did that, Levitas decided to reopen in its location. And right at that time is when I came into the picture.
Yeah.
And when I got to Levitas, Lipsticks was in fact still open over on Ponce de Leon. And I remember at auditions, Shauna Brooks, Lauren Michaels, and Lauren the Masters, I think all three of those were at Lipsticks, and they came to audition for Levitas because they wanted to leave Lipsticks for whatever their reasons were. And they all got hired along with me to come to Levitas. And then Levitas, something happened overnight. It just went crazy. Everybody knew about it. We had sold out shows. It was packed. They were selling merchandise with our pictures on it. It was like making a lot of money. It was really quite the deal for, especially like me coming from Florida, thinking I was somebody, and getting to Atlanta and finding out, oh, y'all don't know me? Oh, I'm not famous like I thought I was. But La Vida sure did help that happen, because I'm telling you, it was a fascinating experience. And our productions there, led by Tony DeSerio, choreographed and put together, were fully wardrobed. We had costume designers. We had people making feather hats. I mean, it was really quite. I have an entire video of my final night there. I left in August of 91. The bar would close in October of 91. And so I left a few weeks before it closed down, and I actually had somebody, I hired them to record the entire night, because they allowed me to pick my favorite productions, and the girls let me pick their favorite show numbers they did. And that's what's on the video, is the numbers I chose for everybody to do, and the productions that I was in that I wanted to, you know, one day look back and say, oh my God, I was young once and I did that.
I knew Tony DeSerio well also. And that was the day when they had, there were a number of male performers in Atlanta. Mark Jones, I think, was another one. And
Mark Jones, Brian Douglas, Ron Sanford, Tony DeSerio, Brian Douglas. I was infatuated with him and Jody.
Oh, yeah. I knew them both.
Beautiful blue eyes, blonde hair. I've never been I didn't have a type in my life, but they were so beautiful, and I couldn't decide, in fairness, if I wanted to sleep with them or if I wanted to be like them. Come to find out, I wanted to be like them.
And they're both great people. Jody is still very active in promoting Atlanta gay history. And he's got a huge channel on YouTube called Jody's Midtown Madness old video clips of shows and pageants and all kinds of things that he did. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's got several clippings that I'm in, actually, over the years. My drag mother, Tina DeVore, had her 25th drag anniversary in 98 or 99 or something like that. And one of my drag daughters, Maya Andrews from Orlando, and I drove up, and we did the famous Dirty Dancing performance from the movie as our performance to be there to show support for Tina. And Jody taped that. And he taped several pageants. I think he taped a couple of the contests I think I lost, and I think he has one that I won. I think maybe Mr. Georgia Peach, I think it was called, or something like that.
I'll have to ask him.
Yeah, I think he still has those. And he has me and Maya doing the Dirty Dancing gig. Actually, he just posted it on my wall. He posts it on my wall about twice a year.
Now, you had mentioned,
we love him.
You had mentioned one performer from Atlanta that I remember very well from my first visit to Illusions, who obviously later worked at La Vida's, and that was Lauren Michaels. And if I'm not mistaken, when I first saw Lauren perform at Illusions, he was doing what you were doing. He was a male backup dancer to the show at Illusions before he started his transition and began doing drag.
You would be correct.
And if my memory wants to tell me, his first name is Ashley Michael, but I might be wrong on that.
But I believe you are correct on that too. I never knew Lauren before transition. I knew her before her body developed and things changed physically, but she'd already transitioned into her new way of life. Right around the time I met her at La Vida's, that's the first time I'd ever met her, was at La Vida's. I'd seen her in Chicago compete for Continental as a bystander, but I never met her until they put me on that show cast. And then I swear I met all of them, Lily White, Bertha Butt, Sable Shepherd, Ashley Cruz, Shauna Brooks. Shauna would become my best friend for life. She's still my best friend. Who else was on our show there? Motion, I think, was there for a while. Cezanne was on cast with us for a while. And oddly enough, Cezanne now is my assistant manager at one of my properties here in Melbourne. Funny how life does things.
It is.
Yeah, we had a fascinating show. Lily White was our MC. I learned how to call the stage the boards from Lily White. She referred to the stage floor as, if you want to come dance on the boards, we'll be having a little in-between shows tonight. And it used to tickle me when she called it the boards.
Yeah, Lily was quite the character. I was sad to hear her passing a few.
We all knew it was coming, Art. I mean, that's fair to say. Right. We knew it was coming because she'd been in hospice for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And when she would come online, sometimes her posts were really weird, you know, because I guess she was hocked up on meds and all that. But my best friend Shauna and Lily were really close. They even lived together for several years, and Shauna took it really hard. She's still taking it really hard.
And of course, after at the time of Levitas and Lipsticks and all this, that was where the drag focus was in Atlanta. It was either Illusions or Lipsticks or Levitas. It was a separate environment. Years later, after all those clubs had closed, Backstreet made a big move. And they took Charlie Brown, who I believe at the time operated Charlie Brown's Cabaret in Buckhead. I think he had his own bar out there. And
like a little small thing. I think you're right. Yeah.
And the Veras at Backstreet lured him over there. And he opened Charlie Brown's Cabaret on the top floor of Backstreet, which became iconic.
Oh, my God.
The bar was open 24 hours a day. And the show.
An interesting side note here. It won't matter to most. It just does to me, and maybe you'll find it amusing. But when you're a competitor in a drag contest or a male lead contest, the only thing that you ever hear when you're on stage waiting for the results are the results. You don't really hear clapping. You don't really hear people screaming people's names. You just hear the results because, you know, you're hoping you're the winner. The very first time I ever won and got sashed in Atlanta, it was Charlie Brown who announced it. And I can still hear his voice right now saying, "Oh, my God, Bob Taylor, you finally got one."
Yeah, Charlie Brown's a character. And he's still,
he is.
He's still out there kicking too.
So, he is. I actually talked to him online some months ago for a few minutes.
And so you had all this great experience at these iconic bars at Renee's in Tampa, at Levitas in Atlanta, at Trax in Tampa, and then you moved back to Florida some years later.
Well, so here's kind of what happened. When I left Levitas, during my time there, I learned how to have a good time. I learned all about cocaine and ecstasy and acid and the good party drinking and staying out for 2 days. I learned how to do all that. Mind you, I had done a little bit of that in Tampa, but I was young and I was just out of college and I was working, so I didn't do much. But in Atlanta, I learned how to really party, and I started losing weight. You know, you can tell I didn't eat much. Me and Shauna were just running around at the Cove. God knows, I know you remember the Cove. We used to love to go to the Cove, and it was always funny to us when people would open the door like 6 o'clock in the morning and the sun would come in. We would freak out like, "Oh my God, it's daylight. Take another pill, do another bump." So when I left there, I was a little burned out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I came back down to Florida and I wound up in Orlando, and I didn't do anything right away except look for the party. And I did that for like a year, and I finally just woke up one day after making some big messes and doing some irresponsible things. And I decided I needed to change my life, that I didn't go to college. I'm from a trailer park in Georgia. I grew up really poor, 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 so poor, and country white trash, if you will, in the dirt roads out in the country. And I had just worked so hard to overcome that lifestyle and to not be that I was kind of leading myself down a bad road that was going to lead me right back to the country. And I decided that I went to rehab. I called my mother and asked her and told her what was going on. And of course, she was devastated. But the first thing she said was, "What can I do to help?" And I said, "Put me in a detox for 3 days where I can't get out, and then let's go from there." So she did, without any more questions. And on the fourth day, I was with her, and I took my little suitcase and went back to Florida, found a job, went to the Parliament House. Tiffany McCrae, another one of my best friends from my early Renee's days and Trax days, said that they were hiring and that I should go talk to Scott. Most watching this will know that Scott became my husband for the next 14 years. I literally walked in, fell in love with the man. As soon as I walked in that room, knew he was the one for me. And apparently that's what he was feeling too. And I went to the Parliament House in 96, and Didn't even have to audition. He had heard about me and gave me the job, and I became an entertainer and backup dancer and choreographer and part-time show director even with him for that place until 2000. And then he found himself in some situations with odds with the owners, and we left, went to L.A. and got out of all the drag world, went to L.A. and lived in L.A. for 4 years, and I came back. He got promoted again with his job. He stayed out there, and we had a long distance love affair relationship until he died in 2009 from a brain aneurysm.
Wow.
So, yeah. But anyway, that's how Part of the House got into the picture.
So a lot of people who have not been to Parliament House or just don't look into the history of things don't realize that Parliament House started out as a mainstream chain of convention hotels around the country in the early 60s. And they were advertised as, they came up with the name Parliament House. Their slogan was built for the House of Lords, priced for the House of Commons.
Yeah.
And they had them all over the country. And then suddenly in the early 70s, they kind of went belly up, except for the one in Orlando, which I guess got acquired by somebody else and became a gay mecca in about 74, 75. So it was kind of an anomaly that there was this 120 plus room hotel with a five or six bars and a swimming pool and restaurant.
On a lake in downtown Orlando. Yeah. How was that in the land of Disney? I mean, really?
I've heard it referred to as a gay Disney World, because everything a gay person needed was there. It was mostly a male clientele in the early years. 120 plus rooms, swimming pool on the lake, everything, and restaurants, bars, everything was there. You could go there on vacation for a week and literally never have to leave the property.
Exactly right. And that's also where I entered two of my very first competitions and lost both of them.
Now, one testament to the popularity of the Parliament House, I heard a couple of months ago, I was interviewing the world famous Cher impersonator, Chad Michaels.
Oh, yeah.
And he was telling me, he was not a pageant queen. He was a celebrity impersonator. And when he was hired to work at Parliament House the first time, he said he felt like he won the lottery, like he had hit the big time. Because this world famous resort that had fabulous shows and, hotel rooms and everything had hired him without being a pageant queen, without holding a title, to perform there. And that's when he knew he had made it.
And I'll never forget him telling us that in the dressing room, we were getting ready for a production. It was his first time booked with us in like 97 or maybe 98. And my husband found him. I didn't know of Chad until Chad was brought to the Parliament House. And my husband had came across him through something. And Chad was sitting back in the back and he said, "Oh my God, I can die and go to heaven. I'm at the Parliament House in Orlando, Florida, and I am a performer here tonight." He could not get over it. He was so, different because he has so much success now. And it's so different because he was like just a little kid in a candy store then. It was just such a different thing. I'm proud to say I've known him for almost 25 years.
Yeah, and he's a great guy too. And
he's awesome. He's so awesome. I love, love, love him.
And even though he's a little bit younger than a lot of the drag queens we've mentioned.
Right.
He still comes from that old school concept of drag. I mean,
he carries the torch. He really does. He carries the torch.
Just like so many others, like Amber Richards.
Yes. I knew Amber very well. I actually danced for Amber backup the night that she was crowned Miss Continental. I was one of her talent dancers. Hardest thing I ever did.
Another one in Atlanta that, they made their own costumes. They were all about presentation. Everything was done to excess. They weren't trying to be just, I got a sequin gown and a microphone. I can lip sync to anything. They really put a lot of heart and soul and effort into doing their shows the way the old drag queens used to do it in, the days of production numbers and everything. They were you know, really into their art.
Yeah, you were speaking of Mark Jones earlier. It's my understanding, because I didn't know Mark Jones. I've actually never met Mark in person that I know of, but we talk a lot online and we've had private conversations, and I very much admire him. I think Mark had a lot to do with, I think they were already doing those type productions in Atlanta. I think he came from like a big theater background and came in, and I think he raised them a level and raised the bar with what he brought in and took Atlanta and drag show productions to a whole new level. And then into the Illusions days, my first time in Illusions, I saw so many productions. I don't remember seeing any individual performers hardly at all, except this one named Lisa Angelique. I was fascinated with her. She was so pale white and had red hair and did a rhythmics number, music. Came out on a motorcycle, infatuated. I was completely cuckoo about her, but I don't know whatever happened to her, to be honest with you.
I don't know. I'll have to ask Ted Binkley whenever I get around to...
Dora DeVille? That's Ted Binkley, right? Dora DeVille.
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Yeah, Dora DeVille. She was the MC at Illusions. Yeah, that's Ted Binkley. Yeah.
Because Ted was one of the owners of Illusions, and he was also a partner in Crazy Rays, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right. I loved Crazy Rays. Yeah, I think you're right, because when I went to Illusions and then started going, like when I could afford to drive up there, Mickey Day worked the front door, and Dora DeVille, I think, was the MC or manager of the bar, or both, and they had Erica Adams and the Lisa Angelique and Tiffany Middlesex, oddly enough, that I would have seen her and then meet her the way I did down the road a few years later. Tissy Malone, I think. Terry Livingston, Paula Sinclair, maybe. Dina Jacobs, Amber Richards. I just remember so many of them that I saw at that place. And I thought that was the most spectacular event place I'd ever seen in my life. It was like a theater. That's all it was. It wasn't a club. It wasn't a bar. It was a theater.
It was. I remember the first time I went to Atlanta, I was living in Nashville, Tennessee, and my boyfriend and I decided we were going up there or down there for New Year's weekend at the end of 82, beginning of 83. And we went to Backstreet for the New Year's Eve festivities and were so blown away that a day or two later, before we left Atlanta, we decided we were going to move there.
That's how we did back then, right? Go to a city and go, yeah, I'm moving here.
And that one day where we made that decision, I found a job, I found an apartment, we turned on our utilities, and 7 days later we were living in Atlanta. And I remember going out to some of the different bars after we got there, and places like Illusions and Backstreet, they just blew you away. You were like, oh my God, because in the early 80s, most of the gay bars that you were familiar with in smaller towns were like a hole in the wall, mom and pop place, you know, with eight bar stools and a dance floor the size of your linen closet.
And, or a jukebox to play your music on.
And those bars just blew you out of the water. You were like, oh my God, this is like a real place. We're real people. We deserve nice thing.
Right. And
it was
fascinating. I couldn't believe that there were so many. My first bar was the Who's Who in Savannah. Are you familiar?
Yes.
You are? Oh my God. Yes. Not many remember. So I was in high school in 82 and I had a little boyfriend that we were doing things that I didn't really understand what it was, but we were having sex, of course. And his friend was older and had invited us to Savannah. And so we were going to a gay bar, and I'm like, what is that? I never knew of a such thing. I thought, you know, we were on this planet alone, and I thought I was going to be fighting these weird feelings and living a secret life my whole life. And oh, my God, we pulled up, and I saw the line out the door, and I went, is that where we're going? He said, yeah. And he said, wait, do you see what's inside? Oh, my God, Art, I walked in, and it was all these beautiful, a lot of men that looked like they were in the military, to be honest with you, which I later learned were.
Right.
And oh my God, they were so like beautiful, and they were shirts off and naked and dancing together. And it's so funny. I don't know what your experience was, but I always tell people, no matter where I went for the first time, in any city, Jacksonville, Tallahassee, these are all my coming out cities, Atlanta, Macon, Savannah, Orlando, Tampa. Every time I walked into a gay bar, I would hear Sylvester singing one of his songs. It was, they had him on the turntable because his music was the fastest and most popular thing happening at that time where people discoed. And it was at the end of the disco era, actually, oddly enough. But that song of Do You Wanna Funk? I can still say I'm standing in line, getting my hand stamped and paying my door fee, rushing to go to the dance floor to dance to that song. And every bar I went in, I swear, it was the first song I heard playing every time.
And we thought it was so outrageous because of the word funk. You know, it sounded like
Do you want to funk
on a mainstream song, and you were like, ooh, we're so cool.
And you know, we say it, we sang the word fuck out loud over the record as a collective group of dance floor, of course.
Of course, but those days were so much different, and the bar scene was so much different. That's one thing that's been really great about this project is, you know, finding all these memories, talking to all these people about their memories from bars all across the country, and, you know, bringing a little bit of fresh light to the things that are getting lost, the memories that are disappearing, because we're not going to live forever. I mean,
and you getting to hear all these stories has to be so good to you because you have all these memories, and it's like having someone to confer with about them finally, you know, that understands exactly what, when you say the way the bars were back in those days, only you and me are ever, no matter who's watching this, only people that will understand that is those that were there. No one will ever understand the nightlife of the late 70s and the 80s as we do, as we will, because it was a fascinating and freeing, very freeing. You just felt like you finally were going to be important in life and you didn't have to hide, you know, from your life anymore. And you could go there and spread your wings and be anything you wanted to be. And it was the safe places are all gone because mainstream, we merged so much. And I always talk about this when I'm like mentoring my kids, you know, be careful what you wish for. Did we really want to be mainstream? We always thought we did because we thought that would mean acceptance. But however, we're now mainstream and we're still not accepted. So who knows?
It was a different time. It was, you know, they were the center of our communities. That's how we met other gay people that later became our friends, our lovers, the people that helped us, you know, work through problems that we were having.
Yeah.
With coming out or being gay at work or family issues. They were really the heart and soul of our community back then. And when you went into a lot of these bars, the owner was there. You knew the person who owned the bar. They were part of the family.
They were.
You know, I know there's one bar owner, I'm sure you knew of her in Atlanta, named Dina Collins.
Dina's one more time. Yes, I know Dina.
The tag
she had the line, other side too, right?
I'm sorry?
She had a place called the other side or the sports page
She owned four bars that I know of in the history of Atlanta. Her original bar was called The Rose, and it was in Cheshire Bridge Plaza, I think, up right where Levita's was in that general area. And it was a lesbian bar. And then after The Rose, she opened Dina's one more time, which was on Cheshire Bridge. And then she opened,
it was a country bar,
Three-Legged Cowboy and Hoedown.
And
Hoedown.
Right.
She opened Hoedown's first, which I believe was in the Dina's location before it moved to the Midtown Plaza.
You are absolutely right.
Then she had a conflict with her partner, business partner, for Hoedowns, and they closed and reopened as Three-Legged Cowboy, which she tells me, and she still laughs when she tells the story. She said, when I named it Three-Legged Cowboy, I was thinking of John Wayne and, you know, a comment that he had made in a movie when he had injured his leg and whatever. And I was thinking of that image. She said, but I later learned that most of the gay boys think that it means something completely different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hello.
So
But yeah, I've been in there a few times. I used to go with Amber sometimes, and then like my first lesbian bar experience was the Sports Page, which is now the Heretic. I didn't know they had a separate bar for boys and girls. I was kind of not real sure what that was all about, but I sure did. One of my little lesbian friends from South Georgia that I met in my early days of coming out told me I got to go to the lesbian bar because there's fewer gay guys in there and there's more selection. The fewer guys means I had more of a chance of getting one of them instead of fighting for all the boys at Backstreet or somewhere.
Right.
She was right. I went to Backstreet and had me some trade within about an hour, maybe twice that night or something, because that's kind of the whore we were back in those days.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, right before AIDS really took over and made a mess, we didn't have a problem with making love. We made love all the time, maybe two or three times a night in the bar. You know, it was really wild like that.
Yeah, it was a strange.
She took me to the Sports Page, and I was fascinated, actually. It was pretty fun. I had a good time.
Atlanta sure had its share of memories there, didn't it?
It sure did. And it still does. Oddly enough, I have not set foot in that city in about 15 years, and it's really time for me to go see some people now that COVID is starting to have less restrictions and I've got vaccinated. Get your vaccine, please. And it's time for me to go see it because one of our friends, Tony Curtis, who was kind of a legend in Atlanta, he judged a lot of pageants. He lived with a lot of the famous drag queens, including Cezanne. And Cezanne, he just died a couple months ago. And Cezanne went up there to the funeral and said, "Bob, it's like I don't even recognize the city. It's such a different place now since when we were just there. So I want to go see all the growth it's gone through."
It has changed a lot. Some things haven't changed, but I was there 6 years ago. And, you know, all the iconic bars, of course, are gone.
Right.
There's the little plaza where Burkhart's was.
Yeah.
Has about five little neighborhood gay bars in it now. Mix. Burkhart's is now called Midtown Moon. Oscars, Felix's. There, and of course, Brushstrokes has expanded into half of the plaza.
Is Brushstrokes still there?
Oh, yeah. Brushstrokes will
they
never
my
go
sponsor.
Away.
When I competed, they were always my sponsor.
Yeah, they sponsor everybody. Mark is still
a
there.
A guy named Mark. A heavy set guy named. Yeah. Oh, my God.
He's still there.
Wow. That's fascinating.
It is. And then the adjoining, you know, Ansley Square has one bar in it. And
on the back side of it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's that little hole in the wall still there, too?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah, I had the pleasure of living across the street in Vaseline Valley for about a year.
All right, then.
Yes. What's it? Ansley Forest?
Ansley Forest is right across the street.
Yeah, those laundry rooms about 3 o'clock in the morning, baby, were no joke.
Atlanta definitely had a history.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to tell us about your memories from back in the 80s and 90s in Atlanta and Tampa and Orlando. And
I'm so happy.
And taking this little stroll down memory lane.
Well, Art, there's a group of us that we all one day somehow should get together and sit down and say, should we write a series, like a docu-series of the era? This totally inspired me. Marty did such a good job with this book. I lived the entire experience through the way he wrote, and it made me want to be back in those days and be part of all that, which was right before I was old enough to be part of it. So maybe we should all get together, us old folks, one day and maybe go to the sawmill or something, camp out and talk about writing a docu-series for Netflix or something. HBO Max. You know, I'm the patriarch of a house like you see on Legendary or the show Pose, the houses that come together, chosen families. So I've had a house of Taylor for about 20 some years now. We're about 103 people strong. We have a private page on Facebook that we communicate in because we're all over the state and the country. And in one case, out of the country. And I've been reached out to, and I had to submit some information and also ask all my family members with my last name, because most of my drag daughters have my last name, Taylor, or they have the letter T as part of their name, and ask us to start hashtagging the House of Taylor so they could start seeing us more they can have more visibility and connect us all together, because they're thinking about doing something like that, I think, on one of the streaming channels in the next year, putting together the pageant families. And I'm kind of happy to say that I think we're being considered. And that's my greatest joy in life now, is being older, is that I help all these young kids the same way Tiffany Middlesex and Tina DeVore and Tony DeSario and Ron Sanford and many other people helped me when I was young and coming up. So maybe we can get together and talk about that sometime too. But I have to tell you, this was kind of one of my fantasies, that I got to be one of Art's boys. Now I'm one of Art's boys. I've done the Art Smith, the Gay Archives now. So I'm really honored to be part of it. And I hope when you're done editing it, I hope it's perfect. I hope it's what you wanted.
I think it will be fabulous.
Well, I'll look for you to hit me up and tag me and tell me it's ready so I can share it to the world.
I will do that.
Much love to you. I look forward to meeting you since I'm in Melbourne, just across the state. We have to meet soon.
We will.
All right. Much love, Art. God bless.
Okay. And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.